Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, an in-depth conversation with historian Dr. Gerald Horn. We discuss the attacks on the New York Times 1619 series, which were timed for the 400th anniversary of the arrival of African enslaved people in the United States. We also discuss concerns, divisions, conflicts in the movements of today. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. President Trump's impeachment trial shifts today to questions from senators. Trump's defense team rested yesterday with its private attorney Jay Sekulow five times telling senators to convict Trump would be dangerous.
Danger. 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 To lower the bar of impeachment based on these articles of impeachment would impact the functioning of our constitutional republic and the framework of that constitution for generations.
But the explosive, soon-to-be-published book from former National Security Advisor John Bolton has altered the math. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell privately told senators yesterday he doesn't yet have the votes to defeat Democratic demands for witnesses. Bolton writes in the forthcoming book that Trump told him he wanted to withhold military aid from Ukraine until it helped him with investigations into Democratic rival Joe Biden. Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer spoke after Trump's attorneys concluded their defense.
So I thought the summation by Mr. Sekulow, the president's lawyer, showed how weak their case was. He said, we don't have eyewitness accounts, that all we have is a newspaper article. Well, Mr. Sekulow, President Trump, we want to get witnesses. You can bring Bolton right into this chamber and he can swear under oath and be cross-examined by you.
Trump's former White House Chief of Staff John Kelly told an audience in Sarasota, Florida, that he believes Bolton. Palestinians are reacting furiously to President Trump's announcement of a Mideast plan that he calls the deal of the century. It recognizes Israeli sovereignty on all its settlements on occupied Palestinian lands and paves the way for Israel to annex them. A settler group in Israel predicted a sharp increase in settlements, which remain illegal under international law. The plan also doubles down on U.S. recognition of all of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, including occupied East Jerusalem. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appeared alongside Trump at the White House to welcome the plan.
It's a great plan for Israel. It's a great plan for peace. Frankly, Mr. President, given all that you have already done for Israel, I'm not surprised. You have been the greatest friend that Israel has ever had in the White House.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas dismissed the plan as nonsense and vowed to resist it. Thousands of Palestinians protested in Gaza. Rami Al-Magari reports.
Thousands of Palestinians took to the streets of Gaza to reject President Trump's peace plan, which is he calling the deal of the century. The crowds represented all parties in the Gaza Strip, including Hamas, which rules in Gaza, and the rival Fatah Party of Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. 50-year-old Raja Radi left her five children at home to take part in the demonstration.
I'm here today to express my anger against this shameful deal, which hijacks our Palestinian rights. I appeal to the Palestinian leadership to stand firm against it with our Palestinian national unity.
For Pacifica Radio, KPFA, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
White supremacist Dylann Roof has appealed his convictions and death sentence in the 2015 massacre of nine black church members at Emmanuel AME Church in South Carolina. the South's oldest black church. His lawyers argue he was mentally ill when he represented himself during his capital trial. His attorneys argue the federal judge presiding over his case should not have allowed him to represent himself because he was a 22-year-old ninth grade dropout who believed his sentence didn't matter because white nationalists would free him from prison after an impending race war. The Prince George's County Police Chief says a Maryland police officer who fatally shot a handcuffed man in the front seat of a police cruiser will face a murder charge. The deadly shooting occurred Monday night inside the car after officers responded to reports that a driver had struck multiple vehicles near the Temple Hills community. The legal director for the ACLU of Maryland said in a statement, "There is no reason for an officer to shoot a handcuffed suspect multiple times inside a patrol car." I'm Eileen Alfandary for Pacifica Radio.
Those were our news headlines, and now we go to our in-depth conversation with Dr. Gerald Horn.
There are a number of things I wanted to discuss with Dr. Horn, but let us start first with the criticism that has been launched against the 1619 Project, which was a project of the New York Times. Dr. Horn, just to fill our listeners in, tell us, what was this project?
So in August 2019, the New York Times Magazine, to mark what they said was the 400th year of the arrival of African labor in North America, in the state we now call Virginia, decided to do an assessment spearheaded by a black journalist by the name of Nicole Hannah Jones to try to connect police terror that has given rise to Black Lives Matter, disproportionate representation on death row, skyrocketing infant mortality rates for black women giving birth, etc., to the ills of the past, slavery not least. Now, this is something of a breakthrough, I must say, believe it or not, for historical projects, because U.S. historians in particular are notorious for treating the past as a kind of thing in itself. And as a result, they've constructed this so-called liberal narrative about the origin of the United States, and basically disdain trying to explain how you had the rise of Trumpism, given the alleged liberal origins of this project now known as the United States of America. Now, all hell broke loose.
Yeah, before we get to the all hell breaking loose, though, a couple of things. We recently did a show, of course, marking the birthday of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. And I attended some events in Fontana, California, with Reverend Barber, who was a keynote speaker at a MLK event there. And, of course, he's a joint coordinator of the Poor People's Campaign. And one of the things that he spoke strongly against, and I agree with, is of people celebrating a monument and making a monument in a way out of King rather than what King stood for, what his demands were, and about picking that up and carrying on that fight. And I'm mentioning it now because it reminded me of what you just said about the connection with earlier history to oppression and discrimination of what's going on today. You know what I mean? It's it kind of falls within a similar vein, Dr. Horn. So
I would add to that that these historians, not only historians, Ivy League historians, I should mention, for the most part, and the Wall Street Journal editorial page, and conservative journals like National Review, and certain forces who consider themselves to be socialists, they really took umbrage towards was the New York Times Magazine suggesting that what gave rise to 1776 and the revolt against British rule was the desire of slaveholders like George Washington, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry to defend slavery. Because we all know that as early as the early 1770s, London had moved towards abolishing slavery in England itself. And there was fear on this side of the Atlantic that decision would leapfrog the Atlantic and jeopardize the immense fortunes of these slaveholders. And, of course, the converse of this idea is that slaveholders did not revolt to defend their property and slaves. They revolted because they didn't like the idea of a monarch, or they didn't like the idea of taxes, etc. Now, what's even more remarkable than this sort of united front against Hannah Jones and her mostly black colleagues is that what this has led to is a flame war on Twitter that is continuing as I speak, and also, to point listeners to another source, it has led to a remarkable rebuke of the critics by the Yale historian Greg Grandin, which can be found on the website of The Nation magazine, where he takes the conversation a step forward when he reprimands generations of U.S. historians for basically ignoring the question of Native American dispossession with regard to the formation of the United States of America, which is quite remarkable. I mean, I know people who consider themselves to be radical in Southern California who don't know anything about the Chumash, the indigenous population that dominated this region before the Anglo and European invasion of about 170 years ago. So this has led to a very enlightening debate. I think that part of the critique of these scholars in particular is that even though many of them consider themselves to be, quote, experts, unquote, on black history, they don't attend conventions of black scholars. As a matter of fact, as I said on another program, they're more likely to be found twerking alongside Lizzo at a Laker game than attending a convention of black scholars to critique. And also, with regard to some who consider themselves radical, it's quite revealing. They seem to feel that focusing on racism towards black people today disrupts the class struggle. I don't think they feel, at least they have not articulated it thus far, that focusing on sexism disrupts the class struggle. Maybe it's, I'm not sure why the difference. But in any case, I find that a particularly disturbing point of view. It's almost as if we have to keep quiet. That's to say, black people have to keep quiet about racism so certain Euro-Americans can continue to bask in the glow of 1776, which obviously is ludicrous. But in any case, I think that this New York Times Magazine piece, in some ways, is a step forward. I mean, it's amazing that it's taken this long for certain black intellectuals and writers to conclude that perhaps the formation of a slaveholder's republic is not in the interest of the enslaved themselves, but better late than never.
I was looking at some of the criticism launched by several historians, all white, it seemed, at the 1619 Project. And one of the things that they, and I'd like to go through a few of them, but one of the things goes back to your point about the American Revolution and, you know, what it was about. And they were particularly upset that the 1619 Project said that the founders wanted to ensure slavery would continue. And that was, and I've heard you speak about this. In fact, you have written about this before. And they're claiming that that is absolutely misleading and not the case. They also criticize the project for criticizing Abraham Lincoln, right, who made some very racist comments, and he might have evolved, but his plan also was that black people after emancipation should leave the United States, right, and go live somewhere else. So, you know, I just wonder if you could underscore a bit more this business about the so-named founding fathers and the American Revolution, and equate that with what was going on in Britain at the time in the UK, where the abolitionist movement was making strides, Dr. Horn.
Well, first of all, with regard to slaveholders rebelling in order to preserve slavery, as your comment suggested, I wrote an entire book about that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I should say that I have an iron in this fire.
I suspected as much. And Dr. Horwin, you mentioned the Twitter wars. I mean, honestly, people put so much time and energy. I was just talking this morning about that, into going on Twitter, bashing people, bullying people. You know, I frankly don't see the point of it, but a lot of people seem to be involved in it. So I'm not surprised right, to hear that Twitter wars are going on this and that, you know, even your work, which is so stellar, that people dare to go on, you know, Twitter or social media to criticize it. But carry on, Dr. Horn.
It's undeniable that during the war that led to the formation of the United States, that more black people fought alongside the redcoats than fought with the slave owners and the settlers. And I think that that should lead to certain undeniable inferences as well. We also know that during the War of 1812, when there was this conflict between Britain and the United States, with the United States trying to seize Canada, that black people once again joined the redcoats, helped to burn down Washington, D.C., sending President James Madison and his perilous spouse, Dolly, fleeing into the streets, and then escaping on British vessels to Trinidad and Tobago, where their descendants continue to reside. With regard to Lincoln, once again, I mean, I have a number of books talking about Lincoln's transgressions. In my book on Brazil, I talked about his protracted negotiations with that South American giant to send all the black people in the United States to Brazil. The Brazilians decided that they had enough black people already, thank you very much, not least because a few decades earlier in the 1840s, U.S. slave traders had raided Congo in particular, dragging Africans across the Atlantic. But the line with regard to Lincoln is, despite the fact that the Brazilians did not want us, which is one of the reasons why we're still here in North America, we're supposed to stress how he evolved. We're not supposed to mention the fact that he tried to get rid of us and was unsuccessful. Yeah. We also know, I talked about this in my book on Dominican Republic and Haiti, that he was negotiating to send us all to the Dominican Republic after the Dominican Republic has seceded from Haiti on racist grounds, too, I might add. But once again, we're not supposed to mention that. We're not supposed to mention the fact that a dominant ethos in the United States historically has been this idea of establishing a so-called white man's country. That's why when Oregon came into the Union in the 1850s, they said no black people allowed, which is one of the reasons why to this very day, Portland, Oregon has one of the smallest black populations in the United States of America. This is one of the reasons why a dark-skinned person like myself, why I listen to a so-called white space, such as a library and archive, oftentimes I'm made to feel uncomfortable because that violates a founding ethos of this country. Nor does this whole dispute with regard to these so-called scholars engage the point that settlers' revolts, such as what rocked North America in 1776, have a rather disreputable history. I'm thinking of the settlers' revolt in Algeria, that almost led to the overthrow of the French government in Paris. I'm thinking of the settlers' revolt in what is now Zimbabwe, then Rhodesia, where Ian Smith, the leader of the European Party, said, quite frankly, that he was trying to walk in the footsteps of 1776 and that he was trying to escape the logic of one person, one vote, and African majority rule, just like George Washington in the country was trying to escape the logic of British abolitionism. These scholars, they tend to be very narrowly educated and very narrowly informed. They'll pick a period like 1861 to 1865 and study that for their entire career. And some of these other ancillary questions, such as other settler revolts, for example, other civil wars, for example, they do not engage. And so they have a kind of blissful ignorance that's compounded by the fact that they tend to disdain connecting the past to the present. It's like going to a doctor and the doctor takes your medical history and you ask the doctor why you're taking the medical history, and the doctor doesn't say it's because I'm trying to learn something about you today. It's almost like they're just taking the history for purposes of gossip or just as a thing in itself. So this whole 1619 Project controversy is raising very profound questions, which is one of the reasons why I think it's attracted so much attention.
Yeah, and not even getting the past right because – You know, back to what was going on in the UK. I mean, that 1772 Somerset versus Stuart decision was really a key one and overseen by Lord Mansfield. And I have a bit of a theory about the naming of one of Jane Austen's books, Mansfield Park. But, you know, that's another story. But interesting, given the title and what was happening at the time. And I'll have to say that one of my relatives from the Caribbean, an early ancestor, actually participated in the famous abolitionist conference that happened from Barbados, that happened in the UK. And it's not to say that there isn't deep racism in the UK, and there certainly was at that time, still is today. We could see what happened with the so-named Mexit, where even a black woman married to a prince basically got booted out of the country by the rather unceremoniously by the royal family. But it also seemed as though the people who are criticizing, the historians who are criticizing the 1619 Project, are overlooking that, and also the mention of the Dunmore Proclamation, which honestly, most of us didn't know anything about the governor of Virginia offering freedom to any enslaved person who would join the British Army. So you're absolutely right in making that case. But it seems as though the historians that are critiquing it are incensed about that. But another thing that they are incensed about, Dr. Horn, is the connection with the rise of capitalism and slavery and the aftermath, so to speak, of slavery and Jim Crow, as you put it, and what is happening when we look at the data of black people today. So just say a bit more about that, because they don't want to make that connection. And one of them, I think, went even as far to say, well, you know, this was totally dishonest. And the numbers that they're giving about how much money was actually earned and or how much the GDP grew was actually wrong. And, you know, it was overestimated. And it's simply because people want to make the case that capitalism is bad, right? Dr. Horn. I mean, to sum it up.
Well, with regard to Somerset's case, I mean, that case is so notorious that there's an entire movie, Belle, which I recommend, starring the actor Gugu Mbatha-Raw, which deals with Somerset's case in quite a way, by the way, and I really recommend it to your audience. Second of all, with regard to the last colonial governor of Virginia, Lord Dunsmore, who offers freedom to the enslaved population, that, of course, incensed and infuriated the settlers in Virginia, helping to drive them to the side of the rebels. Because keep in mind, the rebels were violating the law on a mega basis. I've drawn a parallel, as have others, between Lord Dunsmore seeking to attract enslaved Africans to the British banner with what Lincoln did with the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1863, because keep in mind, the Union government, the Lincoln government, was not doing that well up until the Emancipation Proclamation, which allows black people to join the military, turns the tide, which, by the way, is dealt with somewhat in the award-winning movie Glory, which I would also recommend, albeit with a few more reservations. With regard to capitalism and slavery, and these scholars, they must know that on the eve of the U.S. Civil War, the most valuable property in North America, in the United States, was property of enslaved Africans. And in fact, as I've told my students more than once, one of the reasons why black people are still being persecuted to this very day is that that property was expropriated without compensation. Unlike in Jamaica, Barbados, et cetera, where the slave owners got compensation, the slave owners here did not get compensation, which means that the enslaved property then becomes free, walking around saying that they're equal, which creates a very combustible mixture, which leads to the Ku Klux Klan, Jim Crow, apartheid, and all the rest. And then we already have a whole raft of scholars led by Eric Williams of Trinidad and Tobago, Capitalism and Slavery, Walter Rodney of Guyana, How Europe Underdeveloped Slavery, the Nigerian scholar Joseph Nnakori, talking about Africa and the Industrial Revolution of England, which documents in painstaking detail the connection between capitalism and slavery. Then you have these U.S. scholars who have arisen, and to be fair, some of them at Ivy League institutions, excoriated to this point, who are also trying to make a connection between capitalism and slavery. So this whole 1619 project has led, I'm happy to say, to a very enlightening debate, despite the Twitter wars and despite the defaming comments and all the rest.
Yeah, I mean, one would be hard-pressed to make the case, as some of them seem to want to make, about the lack of connection with the growth of the U.S. as a world power, of the West, actually, and capitalism, and also the slave trade. And the other thing that they were very upset about is how dare the writers in the 1619 Project make a connection. I mean, one person really quotes Frederick Douglass describing his aunt being whipped and how brutal it was and how outrageous it was for Desmond, one of the writers of the 1619 Project, to then connect that chattel slavery with the plight of, and quoting this article, with a modern day office worker, right? And really not wanting to follow that thread. And anybody who read it would know very well that nobody was saying that an office worker having their emails monitored by the boss is the same as your back being opened and blood flowing as a result of being whipped. You know what I mean, Dr. Horn? But this is one of the arguments, it seems, as well.
Well, it's also the fact that some of the scholars in particular, they pride themselves on being gatekeepers. If you read some of the interviews that they gave, some of them expressed shock that they opened the New York Times in August 2019 and there was a segment and a special on slavery, and they weren't consulted. I mean, how dare the New York Times put up on slavery without consulting themselves? And I think that what's happening is that some of these historians, for reasons I've just articulated, they prove themselves inadequate to the task. They have no explanation for Trumpism. They have no explanation for the liberal fantasies that they've constructed about the past and how there are serious people talking about the United States perhaps being on the verge of a new kind of fascism. They don't engage those sorts of questions. So inevitably, they're being swept into the dustbin of history. And then you have folks who say, well, you know, slavery existed since time immemorial, which, of course, does not engage the point of the connection between slavery and, quote, race, unquote, which I'm happy to say is the subject of my next book, which deals with the 16th century and why we're sitting here in North America speaking English, despite the fact that the Spanish sponsored Christopher Columbus and therefore the first mover's advantage in this hemisphere. And when you mentioned Frederick Douglass, I thought that we were going to have this discussion about what I call a kind of originalism. We know that there's, like, for example, with regard to this impeachment debate, that you're going to have all of these invocations of the so-called founding fathers in this Constitution, which, by the way, made ironclad guarantees for slavery and enslavement of people of African descent, despite the fact that supposedly this Constitution was this great leap forward for humanity. But what's even more interesting with regard to this originalism and going back to these long-dead figures is that there's a kind of black originalism. I mean, I've been reprimanded and rebuked by some for using the term settler colonialism to describe what has happened in North America, because Frederick Douglass didn't use the term settler colonialism, so how dare you use
it? Oh, boy.
It's almost as if everything has to be frozen in the past. We cannot have any advance. It would be as if you go into your biology class and you can't discuss DNA because biologists before the early 1950s did not discuss DNA.
Or you can't say the world is round either. The earth is round because earlier science, quote unquote, scientists had said it was flat, right?
Yeah, come, I mean, it, as I said, this whole 1619 project has been very revealing. And by the way, we should also ask, why did the New York Times decide to go in this direction? And, you know, I haven't read their emails and their correspondence, but I suspect that is for a number of reasons. One, journalism, as I'm sure you know, is not necessarily an enterprise that's thriving. Jeff Bezos of Amazon bought the Washington Post from the Graham family for fundamentally coins found in his couch. The Sulzberger family might have reason to think that they need to cultivate new markets. They're in New York City, which has the largest black population in North America. And interestingly enough, one of the critics of the 1619 Project, Peter Koklanis at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, denounced the New York Times, saying that it was no more than a midtown version of the New York Amsterdam News. New York Amsterdam News is the black paper in Harlem. So it's almost as if he feels that the New York Times is sort of illegitimate to make some sort of overtures to the black population in New York. And then, of course, these black journalists in particular, who are mostly behind the 1619 Project, black people in general have historically had difficulty swallowing the creation about the founding of the United States being a great leap forward for humanity, since they knew that it led to an expansion of the African slave trade. It led to the United States slave traders ousting the Spanish as 1790s from controlling the slave trade to Cuba. As early as the 1840s, these U.S. slave traders were controlling the slave trade to the largest market, that's Brazil. And as a result of black people historically having this skepticism about the United States, it's not surprising that with the rise of Trumpism in 2020 and 2019, that this finds expression, it seems to me, in the 1619 Project.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We will now take a station break. When we return, we will continue our in-depth conversation with Dr. Gerald Horn. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. You are on Facebook. You can look for us and friend us there. We're also on Instagram and Twitter. Our handle there is at SoTrueRadio. We're also on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. We now return to our conversation with Dr. Gerald Horn. I wouldn't want to leave this discussion without really challenging another critique. I think it was someone named John Phelan about the 1619 Project. And when he talks about the fact that the number being thrown around now, including in Ta-Nehisi Coates's testimony at the congressional hearing on reparations, and it was just to establish a study. It wasn't about paying anybody any reparations. And he said that by 1836, more than $600 million, almost half the economic activity in the United States, derived directly or indirectly from cotton produced by the million odd slaves. And the 1619 Project, in one of their chapters, that, and if our listeners haven't read it, you can go back and get it, basically makes the case that cotton was to the 19th century what oil was to the 20th century, and that slavery, as we have been discussing, undeniably a font of phenomenal wealth. But he is criticizing the Cornell historian Ed Baptist, who wrote the book The Half Has Never Been Told, saying, well, he did the numbers wrong, because when the GDP, which is the main formulation of national accounts, only incorporates the value of final goods and services produced. Now, as a women's rights activist, we have been challenging how the GDP is done, because it leaves out a lot of our work. And if you look at the data, and so, you know, that's totally bogus because it also left out a lot of the work of people who were enslaved back then. I mean, if you transcribe that, fast forward to women, by 1915, the Global Institute said that women do $1.5 trillion worth of unpaid care work every year just in the United States. And globally, that comes out to about $10.8 trillion per year. Now, none of that is reflected in the GDP, right? So that, you know, that particular claim that the number was overestimated and it's something like $77 million as opposed to $600 million back then is totally bogus on a number of fronts, Dr. Horn.
Well, I think that what this bespeaks is the narrow scope and narrow education, once again, of many of these critics. I mean, once again, some of these scholars, when they talk about the foundation of the United States, they begin the story, perhaps in 1776. If you look at my book, I'll talk about the founding of Georgia in 1733 as a so-called all-white colony, which obviously failed since the 2010 census showed that Georgia had more black people than any other spot in North America and the United States. Or you can go back, as in my 17th century book, to the so-called Glorious Revolution, where the monarch was forced to deregulate the African slave trade at the behest of the merchant class, which leads to a takeoff of the African slave trade. Or, for example, in the next book that I'm publishing, where I go back to the 16th century and the 15th century, and this maniacal search for gold, particularly in Africa, which then leads to the destruction of the Songhai Empire in the 1590s, a joint project of both London and Morocco, which, in my estimation, leads to the downward collapse of Africa in general as that defeat of the Songhai Empire begins throughout the continent. So once again, these scholars, they're too narrowly educated. They're too pro-Yankee. They're always looking for reasons to justify the great leap forward for humanity, so-called. And it reminds me, you could almost say that apartheid, which admittedly uplifted millions of European descent, was a kind of incomplete revolution because somehow they forgot to uplift millions of black people in South Africa nor in North America. In South Africa, of course, they recognize that elementary fundamental fact. In the United States, it takes a struggle to get people to acknowledge reality.
Yeah, our guest is regular here on Sojourner Truth, Dr. Gerald Horn, having an in-depth discussion about critiques and attacks of the 1619 project that came out last year by the New York Times Magazine, marking 400 years of enslaved people, of black people, on the shores of the United States. Turns out it was a bit older than that, if you go back to Florida, but setting that aside, and also a critique of Dr. Gerald Horn himself, who has written before this project came out, the 1619 Project has written books about the very issue and about the what was really behind the settler colonial revolution and, you know, which we're told was about taxes and people throwing tea into the Boston Harbor, et cetera, when there was a lot more to the story than that. But Dr. Horn, on that note, though, and I know there's likely more to be said on this, and I know your time is also a bit pressed, and I'm trying to hold on to you for as long as we can here. But on the issue of reparations, I mean, there was the congressional hearing on reparations. I was fortunate enough to be able to be there and hear the presentations by people that included not only Ta-Nehisi Coates, but also Danny Glover and some other people. But I'm hearing increasingly, and I'm not in the Twitter world, people who are listening right now who may want to go and complain about this show and this discussion on Twitter, forget about it. More than likely, well, you could do it, but more than likely I won't see it, right? You know, there's so much that one has to do with all of the attacks coming down on us, that the idea of sitting and spending hours on Twitter, I don't think is a very good use of my time. But those of you who are into it, you know, that's fine. But I did want to raise, though, this idea that's being put forward by ADOS, the American Descendants of Slavery, and is starting to spread around on social media, that reparations should only go to people of African descent directly connected to the United States, that if you're from the Caribbean region, if you're from Africa, if you're from the African diaspora, so to speak, forget it. And they are very precise about that. They say black immigrants, for example, should be barred from accessing affirmative action and other set-asides, as should Asians and Latinos, right? They even go as far as saying that if you have one parent who was not black, that you, a grandparent, would have to fill out a form to prove that they had actually checked off themselves as black or African American. And one really has to wonder what this is all about. I mean, this kind of divisiveness, but also the lack of understanding the interrelationship of slavery as it was practiced in the diaspora, including in the Caribbean region, and the direct connection that had with building wealth in North America. And I wondered if you had some thoughts on that.
Well, sure. Well, first of all, a footnote about the 1619 Project, per your comment about St. Augustine, Florida, which had enslaved Africans under the Spanish as early as 1565, or the fact, as I say in the next book, as early as the 1520s, the Spanish from the Perch of Santo Domingo brought enslaved Africans to what is now South Carolina, but the enslaved Africans rebelled, defected to the Native American side, chased the Spanish back to the Caribbean, which then opens the door for the English to invade what they call Virginia, 1607. Now, with regard to ADOS, I think that in some ways it's an outgrowth of what we've just been talking about. That is to say that I think that the persecution of the descendants of enslaved Africans in North America has been so vicious and vociferous in the face of this competing counterclaim that actually what this involved was this great leap forward for humanity, that I think it has distorted and warped the vision of some of our brothers and sisters, and that's been compounded by the fact that over the last few decades, there's been a concerted effort by the U.S. ruling class to destroy and weaken organizations across class lines, organizations based on class, such as unions, which then pushes many black people further into this corner because they don't see many of their non-black compatriots necessarily interested in the class struggle. And then you have this anecdote that I quote in my 1776 book, whereby Angela Davis, the vaunted activist, says that growing up in Birmingham, Alabama, when she wanted to get treated like a human being, she would go into a store and start speaking French. In other words, if you spoke English, that meant that you were a descendant of enslaved Africans, and therefore you needed to be treated like trash. If you spoke French, that meant you were a foreigner, and therefore you could be treated in a much more humane fashion. And I think that many black people are aware of this, but they don't necessarily draw the appropriate conclusions from that. That helps to generate and drive an organization like ADOS, which then in turn leads to the actor Samuel L. Jackson, a black American, complaining about the rise and use of British actors like Oyelowo and the folks who played in Queen and Slim, for example, and these other black
the woman who played Harriet and Harriet Tubman.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I think that all of this, in many ways, it really connects to this previous discussion that we had about the 1619 Project and the class and race dynamics that have grown in North America. But I think it's also important to recognize that, as my work has shown and the work of other scholars have shown, with regard to the black population in Dixie, in North America, we've made progress to the extent that we've been able to make international alliances. The Haitian Revolution in the 19th century, with the rise of national liberation movements in Africa and the rise of a socialist camp in the 20th century. And I think going forward into the 21st century, that's the lesson we need to rely on. And any other kind of approach, it seems to me, such as what ADOS is taking, is a kind of diversion, quite frankly.
Yeah, and also inaccurate and a misunderstanding or misinformed about the contributions of people of African descent in the diaspora. I mean, there are they may not know about the enormous wealth that even came out of a little island like Barbados and what that had to do with building up the institutions of Harvard, Yale, William & Mary, Rutgers and Brown University, and the tremendous wealth made in the north of, you know, the shipping of food, et cetera, down to the other British Isles, and the fact that an island like Barbados alone was creating more wealth for England than the 13 U.S. colonies. So there's really a lot of misinformation, not to mention that slavery was so incredibly brutal in some of these small islands, because some of them who didn't have mountains like Jamaica or Haiti, where the slavery was very brutal, of course, people had nowhere to run but into the sea, that they would bring over slave masters from these small islands to the Americas to train slave overseers and how to terrorize slaves. So I think before people get into making those distinctions, they really had better be better informed, it seemed to me. One other thing I've heard you talk about too is the radicals from the Caribbean. Malcolm X is a descendant of somebody from Jamaica. The whole Marcus Garvey movement and the Caribbean radicals in Brooklyn and New York, made tremendous contributions to the fight for civil rights here in the United States. And on the question of speaking French, I have one story that, in a way, I'm sure I believe Angela Davis on that, but I remember coming from the Caribbean and being in high school, and because I was from the Caribbean, teachers in class calling me monkey chasers and coconut heads and did we live in trees and that kind of thing. So we also experienced that coming into the United States. And I really have to wonder why, at a time that we need to come together as Black people globally, people seem to have forgotten about Pan-Africanism. They seem to have forgotten about internationalism and an international perspective. And I would like you to comment on that. Even there's some historic examples of that. And then that leads us also into a discussion about a danger that I see in the movements of today, particularly among younger folks, that are mixing up autonomy and separatism and not understanding that you could be working from an autonomous Black base, but you're also talking about the oppression of and genocide against Native American people, what's happening to migrants across the border, et cetera. So there seem to be two kind of tendencies happening here. One, to divide people and carve them up, right? And another, to figure out how are we going to get together without losing our autonomous base. Dr. Horn, I know that's a mouthful there, but I know you have a lot to say about all of that.
Well, first of all, with regard to one of your earlier points, once again, it needs to be stressed that because enslaved Africans were property, you could be a so-called Afro-Floridian one day, an Afro-Cuban the next day, an Afro-Brazilian the day after that. And so to try to draw these lines, it seems to me, is really, once again, it's a kind of diversion. It ignores the way that slavery worked, the way that slavery operated. Secondly, with regard to Caribbean radicals, fortunately in Southern California, you are blessed by the presence at UC Irvine of the scholar Winston James of Jamaican origin, who's written voluminously on the connections, particularly between Harlem radicalism and Caribbean radicalism, recognizing that about a century ago you had a significant migration from the English-speaking Caribbean, particularly Jamaica, to Harlem, which then, of course, gives rise to and helps to propel the Marcus Garvey movement, which you made reference to. But once again, I would say that a lot of these trends that we're talking about, they're a direct outgrowth of what U.S. imperialism thought it accomplished when it was able to disintegrate a good deal of the socialist camp, which then weakened national liberation movements. And U.S. imperialism thought that that would mean that they would rule the world forever. They neglected to observe that they had to cut a deal with China in order to get in that advantageous position based on Nixon's trip there in the early 1970s. And so the particular international moment, I think, has a lot to do with the trends that you are describing, which once again tells us the way out in terms of going to a higher ground and a higher level is precisely rebuilding the kind of internationalism that has been so successful historically in defeating slavery, in eroding Jim Crow, and I would also say leading us to a better tomorrow in the 21st century.
Yeah, one would think so. And, you know, which brings us, you know, back around to Dr. Martin Luther King. And a lot of, by the way, a lot of people don't know that he actually called for democratic socialism for people who are freaked out by that idea. But yet hold up, Dr. King, because if you look at the moment, the timing of the assassination of Dr. King, that was the time that he was really putting forward a much more fusion approach, the anti-racism, being against the war in Vietnam, announcing the Poor People's Campaign, going around doing a lot of speaking to labor unions, which a lot of people may not know that how much of Dr. King's time went into speaking to organize labor. And I truly think that it was that at that moment that the forces that be, the FBI, et cetera, considered him most dangerous because he had the ability, had developed a class analysis. He had the ability to bring people together across those movements, you know, anti-war, et cetera. And, but yet he was doing it as a black man, a black Southern preacher, so he still had that black base. You know what I mean? And also, similarly, Malcolm X was actually assassinated exactly the time that he had dropped his more narrow nationalist analysis, had traveled abroad, had met with leaders in Africa, had gone to Paris and was talking about the African diaspora, and from an autonomous black base, but saying he was ready to work with anybody who was ready to work for freedom of our people and freedom generally. So there seems to be a pattern here somewhat that people become more dangerous when they cross those divides, and people who, you know, the ones who want to keep people separate and divided and, you know, one from the other can work very well for the capitalist enterprise. It seems to me anyway. Dr. Horn, any final thoughts?
Well, with regard to Dr. King, I'm happy to say that I was once employed by what he called his favorite union, the Hospital Workers of New York City, 1199.
All right.
And not accidentally, 1199 was a union that was built by the left, just as Dr. King got into hot water with the U.S. ruling elite when he refused to break ties with a man who has recently departed the land of the living, speaking of Jack O'Dell, a former chair of the board of Pacifica. Jack was accused, perhaps correctly, of being a former leading communist. Jack consulted with Dr. King, in some ways was an architect of this black freedom struggle in the 1960s. Jack helped to found and wrote for Freedom Ways magazine, and mm-hmm. Dr. King was speaking at a benefit for Freedom Ways magazine in February 1968. When he praised W.E.B. Du Bois and said that just because W.E.B. Du Bois joined the Communist Party late in life should not lead to demerits on his record. And, of course, a few weeks after that, Dr. King was assassinated under very suspicious circumstances in Memphis, Tennessee. So I think that, once again, we have to connect these two factors. On the one hand, you have these prophetic figures like Martin Luther King who arise, who try to connect the dots, who are trying to work across class lines, trying to be internationalists, being anti-apartheid in solidarity with the African Liberation Movement, meeting with Ben Bella of Algeria in the early 1960s, which Dr. King certainly did. But then they're undermined, they're struck down, they're vilified, which then creates a kind of ideological vacuum, which then leads to these various kinds of diversionary trends, which we're now discussing. But once again, speaking specifically with the 1619 Project and this new departure that I see with regard to historiography and the understanding of the United States of America, I think that certain bright horizons are now opening up, and that's all to the good.
Right. Well, on that note and bright horizons, Dr. Horn, thank you so much for taking time. I know of an extremely hectic day for breaking this all down for us. We appreciate you. Thank you, Dr.
Thank
Horn.
Thank you for inviting me.
We're out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, including assistant producer Romero Funes and today's audio engineer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. And remember to visit our website, sotrueradio.org. Follow us on Facebook, our handle on Twitter and Instagram, at So True Radio. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.